Good afternoon, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. We're also on the internet at cjsf.ca, where we stream and podcast all of your favorite CJSF shows, including Endeavors. And, of course, we're also on TELUS HD TV channel 7014. Hello to all my affiliates out there in Halifax, St. John, Fredericton, Cape Breton, and Toronto. Good to have you as always. It's a bit of a sad show, bit of an unusual show today. I know we were all floored and shocked last week with the news of the passing of the great comic genius Robin Williams and the circumstances in which he went. Very unexpected, very shocking, very upsetting to a lot of people. So we're gonna discuss the life and career of Robin Williams with Eli Glasner, who is one of the arts critics for CBC Television. He talks about, you know, what he thinks Robin's legacy will be, his good films, his career. You know, how was he able to do what he did for a sustained amount of time? He was so good at comedy, sketch, improv, stand-up, but he was also really good at straight acting, as evidenced by his win in Good Will Hunting, and his other nominations for Good Morning Vietnam, the Dead Poets Society, and The Fisher King. I know for me, I grew up watching Mrs. Doubtfire. That was one of the films that made an impact on my childhood, and in more subtle ways pushed me into a life of theater and acting. Lately, though, I've been thinking a lot about Patch Adams. I know it wasn't one of his most well-received films, but I really like it, if, you know, for nothing else, if the speech at the end, and also the pairing of Robin Williams and somebody else we lost this year, Philip Seymour Hoffman, was also in that film. And a great cast, too: Monica Potter, Daniel London, Harvey Presnell, Bob Gunton, Joseph Sommer, Michael Jeter. A really, really great cast. And then, of course, Aladdin, which was one of the, you know, one of the first times a major celebrity to lend his voice to a major animated film. Of course, The Genie, and that was one of the many memes we saw on social media in the last week or so. Genie, You're Free, along with, of course, Oh Captain, My Captain. So we'll be talking to Eli Glasner about all that. And then you'll also hear from a great Canadian band, Fucked Up. We'll be here on the show talking about their new album, Glass Boys. And so we're actually going to start with a song by Fucked Up off of their album, Glass Boys. This is Warm Change. Once again, that was Warm Change by the band Fucked Up off the album Glass Boys. And you'll be hearing from them a little later on in the program. But right now we have an interview with CBC film reviewer and art critic Eli Glasner. I am joined on the phone now by CBC arts critic Eli Glasner. Eli, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan.
Well, you're here under rather sad and unfortunate circumstances when we all lost Robin Williams last week. I know when I first heard the news, I was completely shocked and taken aback. What was your initial reaction?
In a way, it reminded me of what happened when we lost Roger Ebert, because I think, like, even though Ebert was struggling, and there were signs that Robin Williams had kind of been backsliding a little and having some trouble and going back to AA and rehab and that kind of thing. But he was, Williams was just one of those kind of fixtures of, like, entertainment in the 21st century. And he was always there. And, like, I mean, he had that new TV show, The Crazy Ones. I never watched a single episode. I think a lot of us real huge Robin Williams fans almost, like, you know, you didn't want to see, oh, he's kind of sullied himself by doing TV. He's got a sitcom, I guess. You got to do what you got to do. But at the same time, we always knew, well, he's there. He's still working. So we just kind of in the background somewhere. And that's what made it such a shock that, you know, just like the day before Robert Ebert passed, there was an update on his website talking about new plans for the future, and then bang, he's gone. And the same thing. I mean, one second, you know, Robin is just there, and he's got multiple movies in production, and no one imagined that he was even in doubt of leaving this earth, and then this horrible news. And, you know, the first thing I thought of when I heard about the passing of Robin Williams was this amazing interview he did with Marc Maron, also a stand-up comedian. He has a podcast called WTF back in 2010. And I think it was our clearest glimpse of the other Robin. And that was someone you really didn't see a lot, because the thing that I think made Robin this kind of like supernova of talent is that he was always on, right? It was just this explosion, this manic improv, constant chain of different voices and accents and jokes and patter. And there was another Robin Williams, but you didn't get to see him that often, except occasionally in movies. But even when he was, you know, doing the talk shows, promoting things, it was always the stand-up comedian, the showman, the entertainer. And when he talked to Marc Maron, you got a sense of the struggle. You got a sense of some of his real dark days, falling into addiction, getting on the wagon, falling off the wagon. I mean, it was great to see this quiet, intelligent man and get to meet that Robin. On the other hand, it's kind of sad that we saw him so rarely.
One of the things that people have said about Robin, and that which is rare, is that not only was he an amazing comedian, but he was also a better actor, and that's not always an easy transition for a comedian to make.
Yeah.
What made him so good at everything he did?
I think if you look at a lot of stand-up comedians, if you look at the great stand-up comedians, what they are at the end of the day are great watchers. They're observers, right? And what Robin did, I mean, from all accounts, he was incredibly intelligent. He was a voracious reader. You know, someone gets sitting next to him when he's going on one of those tours to perform for the army, and he's reading a book about the history of Iraq. I mean, he wants to know a little bit about everything, and evidently he did. And that's how he was able to make those amazing jumps in his comedy and go from subject to subject. So he had a way. I think he was, I don't want to make it sound like a superhero, but I think in some ways he was kind of functioning at a higher level. He was a great observer. He saw everything. Everything was seen by those big eyes of his, and he took it all in. And then, you know, you can do two things with that information. You can make it into comedy, and you can kind of play it for a laugh, but you can also use it for your performance. And so I think that's what made him a good actor, is that he saw it all and he took that in, and that was fuel, and it did give us some great performances. Now, the thing about Robin is he was kind of up there with like Christopher Walken. He was one of those actors who was just always working. So he has such a ridiculously large body of work. Sometimes it's hard to see some of the gems because there's a lot of other stuff in there that's, you know, not so good. There's the RV, and there's Jack and Patch Adams and all the rest. I mean, he wanted to keep working. But, yeah, there is an amazing range. And I think it took him actually a little while to kind of convince Hollywood that he was more than just laughs, and that he could do better parts. I mean, you look at something like Awakenings, right? That amazing film with Robert De Niro, where Robin pretty much has to play it straight for a lot of the film, and there wasn't, you know, you could almost feel like the tension. But that's when you got to see the other Robin and a little bit of that sadness. And I think, you know, you ask kind of what made it great. Well, I think what he was connecting with in a performance like that, when he's trying to like reach out to these patients who are kind of locked in their own world, is there was kind of his own turmoil, and he was open enough to, when the cameras were rolling, when the right part was there, to allow himself to kind of access that and let us see a little bit of that own kind of sadness that he carried.
So, given that he has such a large body of work, what is your favorite Robin Williams film, or what's a couple of films that stand out for you?
You know, I'm sure there's much more serious choices, but for me, I have to go back to Good Morning Vietnam, and part of it is it's kind of a sentimental favorite of mine because that was one of the movies that really kind of turned me on to Robin Williams it kind of deepened my relationship with him. I mean, I knew him from Mork and Mindy. I'm old enough that I actually remember a bit of that. And I had one of his early stand-up comedy cassettes that I played again and again. I think it was called A Throbbing Python of Love or something. And frankly, I think I was too young to even understand half of the stuff that he was doing. Like, he was just flying so fast. I mean, Good Morning Vietnam was an amazing film. It was an amazing vehicle for Robin Williams playing the DJ, Adrian Cronauer, in Vietnam, directed by Barry Levinson, great kind of comedy director, the kind of Barry doing what he does best. What I liked about it is that it was, in some ways, kind of the classic Robin Williams. You know, he's basically doing kind of his improv stuff. He's this DJ. He's kind of riffing on Vietnam and what's happening in America at that time. And I guarantee, you know, half of what he was doing wasn't scripted at all. It was just Robin going off, and they're kind of picking the best bits. But there is another part to that film where it actually takes a turn kind of for the worse, and where he actually is to kind of confront the madness of the war in Vietnam and his own kind of personal life in shambles. And it had both sides there. And I think he did that, you know, when he kind of realizes what a kind of horrible farce this has become, and you kind of see that on his face. And there's even that great scene where he's entertaining the troops. I think they're stuck in a traffic jam in Saigon. And I guess at that point, Adrian, the DJ, was a bit of a celebrity, so they're kind of bugging him to do his bit. And you see the reluctance.
Yeah.
And he had that reluctance, and that's real, right? It's like you don't always want to be that guy. You don't always want to be on. But then he starts, and he can't stop. And then he's just riffing, and he's making fun of the soldiers and having a great time. And it's a great scene, and it was a great example of the way Robin could connect. And there's so many stories now. I mean, Terry Gilliam and David Simon, everybody's telling these stories about how Robin would entertain the crew. Even the cameras are off. The guy couldn't help himself. He's going and going and going. And that you get to see on camera. And so that's why I would stick with Good Morning Vietnam. I mean, The Fisher King is a great example of also kind of a classic Robin with, again, that kind of undertone of sadness. I mean, that's what I like the best, is when you get the kind of the sweet and sour. And I also, I'm probably one of the few, but actually quite like the bizarre, you remember the 1992 or something, 90 film, Poise.
Yes.
The other side to Robin was a very, well, there was a, I guess a third side, you could say, in a way, was a very kind of childlike side, where he would just kind of, the very kind of innocent side, and that was a great example of that, in a way.
In a way, I think it's rather unfortunate of how he died, because when somebody goes like that, that becomes their legacy, almost. What do you make of that?
I'd like to think that his body of work and his talent is so great that in the end it will shine brighter than this dark patch. And at the same time, I'd like to think that some of the awareness of the issues that he was struggling with, and kind of, it was like this massive wake-up call, right? It was like, oh, well, if this could happen to Robin, and if Robin Williams, who was so successful and had so much, could be struggling so hard and battling depression, and it took him down, well then, maybe some good would come of it. But I don't think that will be the only part of his legacy. But I do think it does help fill in a little bit of the real picture of him. Because you can't really appreciate him as just this, you know, this dancing clown. You have to see the other sides. And unfortunately, in the end, I guess the other side got the best of him. But that was definitely part of it. If you look at a lot of comedians, unfortunately, a lot of that laughter comes from a dark place. I don't think he would have been as amazingly talented and such a great entertainer and such a funny person and smart, observant person if there wasn't that other part of him that was dissatisfied, upset, angry, searching, locked in a bit of a struggle. I think that's fuel. I think you know, you have your yin and your yang, and he was both. And yeah, it's going. There's always going to be a bittersweet, to our love of Robin Williams, but it's also, I think, a reminder of where part of his talent comes from, and that really appreciating Robin, the full human being.
Why do you think it is that, you know, so many geniuses or so many people who have this, you know, heightened intelligence are so troubled on the inside?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I don't want to make too much of a generalization. I mean, like I've said before, I do feel like in some ways he was, you know, he was functioning on like a higher level than the rest of us. It certainly seemed that way sometimes, and he'd been able to kind of make those kind of jumps and connections and improv in a way, like, for, you know, 45-minute sets without flagging. You have to have some amazing neurons in your, you know, brain matter there to be able to do that. But he's not just looking for jokes. When he's looking at the world, he's seeing all the good and all the bad, and so he was able to kind of, you know, filter it back out for us as some great performance and stand-up comedy and what have you, and occasionally great acting performances. But I think he's also taking in, he's seeing everything. He's seeing the good, the bad, and the ugly, and I imagine that takes a toll on you. It's also a question of, like, his own background. I mean, his father was a traveling salesman. I think he worked for one of the big car companies. He kind of describes himself as somewhat desperate for attention. And so there are certain things that kind of set in motion what happened. But, it's ultimately hard to say. I mean, I guess if there is a sadness, it's that, you know, you see some of those performances, even when he goes on talk shows, it's almost as if he was uncomfortable being himself, being the other himself, being the quieter version of Robin, and so he feels this need to perform, and he does it so well, and he gets so many laughs, like, who could begrudge him? But you do kind of wish in some ways he was a little more comfortable in his own shoes, and then maybe we'd still have him around, I guess.
He's got, I believe, 4 films that are currently in post-production.
Yeah.
Which of those are you excited to see, or should the world be excited to see?
not the greatest thing to be waiting for, to be honest. I mean,
yeah.
I'm looking at Merry Friggin' Christmas. It looks all right. It could be promising. There's some animated things in the works. There's Night at the Museum, the next one, where he's Teddy Roosevelt. I think if you want to really see the measure of the man, I think the best thing to do is to pick some of your favorite films, or really him when he was at his best, doing stand-up. And, you know, maybe, I don't know, I can try to think of, like, the best time period when he was somewhat clean and just kind of doing his thing on stage. It seemed to me, and what I've heard from interviews with him, is, you know, that was really kind of his refuge. That's where he could go and he wasn't just getting applause for being Robin Williams, because after 2 minutes, okay, they want to hear some funny, so he still had to work, and he still had to find a way to connect with that crowd and entertain them. And I think that's the way I'm going to remember Rob. And we're not going to have any more stand-up to look forward to, but there's certainly a lot of it out there. And rather than, you know, looking forward to Dennis the Dog from absolutely anything, I don't even know what that is, but that's something that's in the can that's coming up. I'm going to, you know, I'll probably find that old cassette I had from the mid to late 80s and put that in tonight.
The fact that you still have a Robin Williams cassette is quite impressive.
I listened to it a lot. It was a big part of my teenage life, I guess.
Well, Eli Glasner, thanks so much for your time today.
No problem, Dan. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Alrighty, cheers. Have a good one.
All right.
And that was CBC film critic Eli Glasner. Be sure to follow him on Twitter at GlasnerOnFilm, and also you can visit his blog, where he posts a lot of his excellent reviews, and that is glasneronfilm.blogspot.com. That's Glasner, GLASNER, onfilm.blogspot.com. And you are listening to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. Also on the internet at cjsf.ca, we stream and podcast Endeavors, as well as every single other show on CJSF. You could be here all day, which is a good thing. And of course, TELUS HD channel 7014. Okay, we are going to hear another song from the band Fucked Up. This is the title track off the album Glass Boys. So that, once again, that was Glass Boys by Fucked Up off their album of the same name, and we have an interview with them coming up shortly. Just a final note on Robin Williams here, but before I move on, it's death, I guess, for me anyway, came at a strange time. It's sort of weird and selfish as that sounds. I'd been talking a lot recently with a couple of people about our struggles with depression and mental illness, not even from a from an arts or from an acting perspective, but just, you know, from a human perspective, as a human being who suffers, not to the extent that Robin Williams does, well, me personally anyway, but as someone who has struggled in the past, and as someone who has had friends who continue to struggle, and, you know, has known someone who has taken their own life, it was shocking for the most part, mainly because it was so unexpected. It came out of the blue. There are times when I still struggle to find the right words, being much more comfortable writing it than actually speaking it, speaking words. But you may remember Mara Wilson, who played the youngest daughter in Mrs. Doubtfire, and has since left acting, but has been very active on social media and Twitter, and has written a number of really well-written articles on a variety of things. And she just released an essay that the Daily Beast had published. So I just want to read a little bit of that. Robin would do anything to make me and the other kids laugh. Those hand puppets that dance alongside the genie in Aladdin's Friend Like Me, that must have been his suggestion, because Robin made those in real life. He'd break them out in between takes to entertain us. Between takes. "I don't like you," his left hand would say to his right. "You smell like poop." I would laugh uproariously. I was 5, so poop jokes were the height of hilarity, as his right hand yelled back, "Well, there's no toilet paper in my house." When he saw me watching him work on his laptop during downtime, he played a sound file of Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz screeching, "You wicked old witch." When we were filming the petting zoo birthday scene, he fed a pony oats out of his hat, then held it up to me and said, "Want to wear it?" When we were filming under the climactic dinner party scene, he would make his carpet bark like a dog under the table, then order it to be quiet. He seemed to know instinctively what we would find funny, and never had to resort to saying anything that was inappropriate for children. He was, after all, a father himself. As of this past Monday, Robin and I hadn't spoken in a few years. We weren't on bad terms. We just lost track of each other. He was still working in films. I was not anymore. He still lived in California. I'd probably moved 9 times since I last had his contact information. The last time I saw him, I was a freshman at NYU, and he was filming August Rush in Washington Square Park. I went up to him while he was walking away from the set to his trailer and called his name. He turned around, not sure what to make of the girl in the glasses in NYU calling him like she knew him. "It's me," I said. "It's me, Mara." "Oh, Mara," he told me how grown up I looked, and asked how I liked NYU. It was small talk, but something about the way Robin looked at me made it feel like he truly cared. This was someone for whom everything mattered. And that was a portion of the essay written by Mara Wilson, published by the Daily Beast, dailybeast.com. The title is "Mara Wilson Remembers Robin Williams. We Were All His Goddamn Kid." So it's a very, very powerful. I'll say Mara Wilson sure has a power of the written word. She says it so better than many of us were able to. Billy Crystal simply wrote, no words. Anywho, moving on after that sad but poignant essay. We're going to hear another quick track from Fucked Up, and then you're going to hear it with an interview. Is Led by the Hand. Fucked Up. Sandy, hello, welcome.
Hello.
So this new album is Glass Boys, and I know it's your guys' fourth full-length. Where would you say the genesis of this project started from?
Well, it was the previous summer that we were meeting up at the space every day or every couple days for, you know, 3-4 hours and just hash out some, you know, riffs and stuff and kind of talk about, you know, where the record's going to go a bit, or but also just like bringing riffs and then just like putting them together. And yeah, so it was like summertime 2013.
Now I've read that this album sort of has the theme of sort of growing older and aging in the punk community while still sort of clinging on to the punk ideals. And I feel like, at least in the mainstream culture out there, there's this idea of what punk is, you know, kind of the brash youth with the, you know, tattoos, the mohawk, the black leather vest, the studs, the chains. Mm-hmm. But for you, what does being a punk mean, or being a part of the punk scene mean?
Well, punk is something that I've debated probably ad nauseum during my adolescence, when I was doing a zine, doing a radio show. It's all we talked about, right? And like punk ethics, DIY ethics, like questioning religion, like questioning, you know, how societies work, or like, you know, the mechanisms of like modern civilization. And, you know, I'm like, and now I'm older and it's changed a bit. How has it changed? Well, I think about it way less. I don't think about it in terms of punk. I just think about it in terms of like being cool and just and, you know, decent.
How would you say the punk scene, you know, either, you know, the music or sort of, you know, the punk artist scene, I guess, has morphed or transformed from the time you were a teenager until now?
I mean, like, it's, when I was a teen, you know, I'd be listening to skate punk. And then at some point I stopped listening to skate punk. So I don't know really how it transformed. All I know is how I transformed, and that was a move away from skate punk. Like, you know, yeah, there was a time when I like, you know, a bunch of bands back then. But, you know, over time, like, you grow as a person and yeah, and I think you react differently to things. Or, yeah, so that's my answer.
Being a female in the punk scene, because we don't see a lot of necessarily, you know, hardcore bands that have a lot of chicks in them. Is that an important side of your artistry, you think, bringing this female identity to the punk culture?
Well, when I decided to play bass, it wasn't about what it would mean for the greater scene. It was about me doing what I wanted to do. And as a teen, you know, going to shows and getting to know bands and like getting to play in my band in high school, like I just developed the yearning to want to keep doing it and to be able to tour and travel and have a lot of fun and crazy experiences. So the motivation was definitely very selfish, and it wasn't more so to, like, you know, try to represent anyone else.
How do you find the punk scene in Canada and in a big city like Toronto?
You know, there's so many different factions or facets. I mean, like, I can only speak from one viewpoint, which really, I mean, yeah, I'm like, I'll still go to shows sometimes, but it's like a different kind of punk, or, you know, different kind of hardcore. Like, there's so many different kinds of punk scenes going on that I really can't speak for any of them, I feel. I don't know. I feel like I'm a little removed, you know, from the punk scene that I once knew, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Is there, you guys are out on the West Coast now. Is there a different mentality you think out here on the West Coast versus East? Is there like an East-West thing going down?
As far as our shows go, I don't know. I mean, Toronto audiences sometimes, I mean, for other bands, we've been lucky, but other bands have a reputation for sort of being a little still, but for us, like, we've been lucky. Our crowds are kind of good everywhere, so I can't really distinguish, like, a difference between the two crowds. They're just both enthusiastic crowds.
It strikes me, you know, I was looking through sort of the song list on this album, and you got a couple of songs that are 5-6 minutes long, which seems quite unusual for punk. You know, I think, again, there's this idea that, you know, punk songs are these short, quick, intense riffs. So where do these longer songs come from?
Well, it's funny you say that, because actually the average song length on this album is shorter than any album that we've done before. So, you know, if you go back to Hidden World, you know, or Chemistry, like, it was pretty common to see, you know, it was kind of a joke, you know, like, if a song is like over 5 minutes long, is it a fucked up song?
Yeah.
Back then, like, during a certain period, for me anyway. So, yeah, we've played around with lengths before. I mean, we have the Zodiac series. The songs are, like, between 10 and 18 minutes long, just because, like...
For the hell of it.
Yeah.
How would you describe your writing process? You talked a little bit about the sort of, you know, getting together and coming up with riffs, but is it kind of anything goes for you? Is there, you know, or do you do, like, lyrics followed by... instrumentation? Is it reverse? Is it just kind of whatever comes to mind first?
Usually people throw out riffs. Sometimes they're kind of playing them anyway at some point. And then, I mean, the way I see it is, like, the principal songwriters, it's like they bring in these, like, pieces of cloth, you know, some cotton or something, whatever.
Yeah.
And then we come together and we, like, sew a suit together, you know? I mean, there's only so much that, you know, like, not everyone could be a lead writer. I mean, as a bass player, I got three guitars around me. I got to just find the middle. That's my preoccupation.
Yeah. You mentioned before the interview that you were mustard gas for a while, but you chose to be introduced as Sandy. Is it two personalities of the same person? Are you playing a character?
Not now, no. You know, we've been doing this for over 13 years, and I don't know. I don't know why I decided Sandy. But I did. I don't know.
And finally, would you say that you have a favorite track off of the album?
The new one?
Yes.
Well, I really like the ending in DET. I find that it's just, like, powerhouse. It's an assault. It's just like an auditory assault. It's pummeling. It sounds like war is breaking out or something.
All right. Well, the album is Glass Boy, Sandy Miranda, Fucked Up. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And that was Sandy Miranda, who was the bass player of Fucked Up. And I spoke to her in the green room of the Fortune Sound Club, and it's got to be one of my favorite green rooms. It's just lovely with all the records in the background, and just a really nice space. My thanks to Sandy Miranda and Fucked Up for joining me today. My thanks to Eli Glasner in helping us all remember Robin Williams. And just remember that if you are ever in distress, you can call the helpline of Greater Vancouver at 604-872-3311. You can also call toll-free at 1-866-661-3311. There's a TTY number at 866-872-0113. For the Seniors Distress Line at 604-872-1234. And, of course, there's 1-800-SUICIDE. And if you happen to be listening to us in the U.S., you can always call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Okay, we're going to take you out with another song by Fucked Up. This is DET. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.